Jenkins.
And welcome aboard. It's Saturday night. We call it Open Mind. And what a night we have in store for you tonight. It certainly is almost deja vu for me and for those of you that have been along on these little seminars we take every Saturday night. This trip into a new time and space and place. It'll be some old friends will come for. I remember back in that November day of 1979, the very first Open Mind show that I did. It was a new journey for me that night, and we want to pick up that journey. We talked about it a lot. It was the fascinating experience of a gentleman by the name of Billy Meyer, one-armed farmer that lived in Switzerland, that back in 1975, 76, just for some reason or another happened to have an ongoing series of contacts with beautiful ladies who came in spacecraft and talked to him. They identified themselves as being from the Pleiades star cluster, a planet up there called Hera. Well, the story was imaginative, but what was interesting about the story and grew more and more interesting was that it was supported by hundreds of photographs and also some movie footage, rock and mineral samples, alloy samples. Marcel Vogel, who was here on the show, Dr. Marcel Vogel, then with IBM, said he had never seen metal samples like that. He had never seen an alloy like that. He had never seen one that could be milled like that. He had a chance to sample those. So there were a lot of things about the Billy Meyer story. They led us to believe that there was something very true about it. Tonight, we have with us one of the chief investigators on that case as it transpired, started some time ago, and I'm very delighted to have him with us tonight, speaking to us from Arizona. Mr. Lee Elders. Lee, welcome back to Open Mind.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Well, I'm just doing fine, and I'm looking forward to what we have going tonight. Because I think tonight, Lee, we'll have one of the first opportunities to, as our good friend Paul Harvey would say, get the rest of the story.
Well, let's hope so.
A lot of things have happened with the Billy Meyer case. When it first started getting national attention, it was exciting to a lot of people. And then a lot of people decided that this really wasn't true, that the photographs were all rigged, the sounds were wrong. And what went wrong? What happened? Why was that?
Well, that's a very complex question. Let me try to answer it this way. In 1978, when we first got involved, we had a lot of pioneering to do. And one of the first things we wanted to do with this case is keep it out of the politically charged atmosphere of ufology. And I think in doing this, I think we create a lot of enemies, and I think a lot of disinformation came down about the case.
Well, a lot of enemies in that you didn't share a lot of information with them as the chief examiners over there or the people getting into it. That seems to be a lot of the input I had.
Well, that's absolutely correct, Bill. Although we did make overtures to one very large UFO organization. We asked them if they wanted to get involved with us. We asked their director. At that time, the answer was no. The reasons given, the long distance over there, we don't have the funds to do it. We don't have the manpower to do it. If you want to pay our expenses, take us with you, we'll be glad to go. At that point in time, we felt, well, let's pass on this one, let's go see what we can find out. And this is what we did. Later on, when we came back, we started bringing evidence, hard evidence back with us. All of a sudden, they wanted to get involved. They wanted us to turn information over to them. Certain photographs, certain negatives, metal samples, things of this nature. Obviously, we refused.
Now, Lee, I know you're stuck up there in the woods in northern Arizona. Wonder if you could talk a little closer into the telephone there or something.
Let me try changing phones here. That might help.
Okay. We're speaking to Lee Elders, who, along with Lieutenant Colonel retired Wendell Stevens, were the chief investigators of this very fascinating case of Billy Meyer. A case now in which there are a number of eyewitnesses. There have been some incredible things that have happened over there.
Bill, is this any better?
That's 100% better.
Okay.
You get an A on that one.
All right. So much for the headset.
Okay.
Now, where were we?
All right. So you were talking with one of the large UFO organizations, as my memory recalls. That was APRO. That they wanted to get involved after you started doing the spade work.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Well, you know, going back to that beginning, let's go back in a proper manner here. First of all, Wendell Stevens, retired Air Force colonel, been chasing UFOs for some 30 years. He approached us in 1977 and asked us to get involved with this case in Europe. Approaching us, meaning approaching Intercept, a security firm that I own. I asked him, why did he want us involved? He said, well, I want professional investigators. We were honored at the time, but we were not interested. At that time, we were dealing with a lot of multinational clients. And our feeling was, you know, the field was so stigma-ridden that we really didn't want to get involved. Wendell was persistent. He went over. He came back. I noticed a big change in him. And at that point, we decided to throw our hat in the ring because he had brought back a lot of hard evidence. And this excited us. So then we jumped in. We got involved. Our first trip was April 1978. My wife, Britt, and I, Wendell went over, spent 5 days there. I was impressed by Meyer, but I still wasn't convinced. I felt that maybe the guy is hoaxing it, but how is he hoaxing it? So at that point in time began about a two-year search, my own search, to try to determine if this guy was real or not. In the meantime, the UFO groups were really on our case real bad. They were claiming we didn't have any evidence. First, they were claiming we were withholding evidence. Then they started claiming we didn't have any evidence. Then later on, claims were made that we'd stolen some of the evidence, meaning from Marcel Vogel, talking about metal specimens now.
Mm-hmm.
So it got deeper and deeper. Finally, got to the stage, they were no longer interested in looking at any evidence. They became very interested in character assassination. At that stage, we pulled our horns in, Bill. We said, none of this. We sat on the evidence, and we took our lumps for several years.
You know, I have a question that just comes to mind here, Lee. Something I want you to mull over as we take just a little break here. Here is a man who claims to be having one of the most, should be one of the most fascinating experiences the whole world should be deeply interested in. He's talking to astronauts from a very different place. They are telling him many things about our beginnings, about our history, what's wrong in our society, how we can solve it. They've made offers to do a lot of things for us. And who is it that goes and investigates this? The governments? The Air Force? No, it's UFO groups. Why is that? If this is so, and he had that kind of information behind him, where was Uncle Sam? Where were people who could really, totally get involved and do a first-class job instead of, not that you didn't, but other than flying saucer groups who happened to have an interest in that? I'm Bill Jenkins, talking to Lee Elders tonight. We're talking about the UFO in general, but certainly the UFOs from Pleiades in particular. Is it that the investigation of something which had all of the earmarks of being vitally important to the world was left to just private individuals instead of getting the kind of attention you would think that it should have?
Well, in the beginning, you know, this bothered me as much as anything because, you know, Intercept had a track record. We had worked with various government agencies in the past. We knew their modus operandi in certain areas. But we couldn't really see anything on the surface here that indicated that they were involved, that they were interested in this case. But today, 5 years later, we're finding out a lot of things. We're finding out that there was a lot of behind-the-scenes activity going on.
On the part of government?
We think so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the metal areas, especially in other areas, especially the hard evidence.
The hard evidence. Photographs, movies, rock and mineral samples. Even samples of hair. Of course, the hair was like anybody else's hair, so you can't really say that that was much evidence there. What's happened to all of that evidence?
That's a good question. One of the major problems when, let's go back to the beginning again. Right before Intercept got involved, I told Wendell, I said, look, if we're going to get involved, we definitely want to control whatever evidence comes. We want to make sure that it is protected. We want security around this man. We want to protect him, because at that period of time, he'd already had some attempts against his life. So,
why had he had attempts on his life?
Well, there were many and various reasons. There was one woman, Billy has never told us who she is, but he said later on she joined their group or became involved with their group. But she tried to shoot him. She felt that he was part of a satanic situation that was developing around the Antichrist. She thought he might be one of the Antichrist because of the seven sisters, the Pleiadian contact. Somewhere in the Bible it mentions, I think, that the Antichrist movement would begin in a connection with seven. And a lot of people thought for many years it might be the seven hills of Rome, might be Catholicism.
Well, seven is just permeating throughout the Bible.
Totally. Yes.
It's built upon sevens.
Yes.
In a very majestic mathematical way.
But going back to your earlier question, we did our damnedest to provide security on this, but we ran into a major problem when it came to the scientist. We lost several negs, internegatives, because we had to ship them off to scientists. We couldn't get people to come into Phoenix and analyze the material. So eventually we had to begin to trust various scientists. And of course we made some bad choices in the beginning, some bad picks. And also, there seems to be some form of an obsessive energy or quality that develops when it comes to the Pleiadian case. People that get information, that receive information, all of a sudden feel that they don't want to part with it any longer. They don't want to return it to the original owner. Billy ran through this before we ever got to him. He had lost hundreds of photographs.
Souvenirs, as it were.
Pardon me?
Souvenirs of some sort.
Oh, yes, yes. It's like a friend once told me who was in the gold dredging business down in South America. He said, you know, you can take the most honest dredge people that work on these dredges. I mean, they wouldn't steal anything, but yet when it comes to that river and those gold nuggets start coming up through that suction hose, they see one, they like it, they stick it in their pocket. And to them, it's not stealing. And I think that analogy held true for this case as well. They didn't feel they were stealing anything. They felt it was in better hands, quote unquote. So we ran into problems there. And when we did, we started losing material. We lost metal fragments. We lost negatives. We lost a lot of things.
Well, some of the pictures that came out of it, there have been great cries that they were fakes or that they were models.
Well, you know, it's easy to sit back in the United States or any country and look at Volume 1 or Volume 2 and say, my God, those pictures are, they're great, they're beautiful, they're the best we've ever seen, the best photo evidence to date. But, and so many of the so-called, quote, experts said this, they said, but they're too good to be true. And I had the same feelings when Wendell brought those photographs in. I'm sorry, when Lou Zenstock brought the first Meyer photographs in to his house down in Tucson, Britt and I, we were staying there with him, and my first reaction, Bill, was, hey, these are too good to be true. We've never seen anything like this. So the point of the story is this. It's easy to second-guess things. But I went there, and I walked those sites, especially Hassan Bull. I've been to Hassan Bull probably a dozen times. And every time I've been there, the wind is blowing fiercely there. It's always cold. It's windswept. But how a man, or anybody, especially a one-armed man, could hang a model there is beyond me. I just rule that out. It was totally impossible. Then when you see the beam ship movie footage, forget it. These definitely are not models.
Well, in the beam ship movie footage, there is one section, and you know, I mentioned that to you, that looks like it may be a model hanging on a string. Until you look at it closely, it doesn't behave quite like a model. Obviously, it was very, very windy. And this model also was causing the top of the tree to bend.
Right.
And that would have to be one heck of a model.
Well, that's a general consensus of a lot of friends that I've showed this footage to, and the same thing. Another thing you want to look at in that one segment, you're talking about the segment now where the beam ship flies around the tree and over the farmhouse, right?
Right, uh-huh. And in a sort of a circular thing.
Right.
Now, I realized that Semyonov the astronaut was trying to keep the beam ship in camera range at all time, for it was a photo opportunity for Billy Meyer. But she was doing pretty good at that.
Well, you know, there's a real mystery to that segment. I want to share it with you because very few people know this. In 1978, when Wendell brought back the movie footage, he brought back a copy of the 8mm footage. And we must have watched this 20, 30 times in his home, throwing it up on a wall or throwing it up on a screen. And never once in that year and a half period did we ever see that tree move with this scene we're talking about now. We didn't see, I never saw it move, until the Japanese MTV arrived at the Meyer farmhouse, and the beam ship footage is compiled of what they shot in Meyer's living room off the wall with their video camera. And that was the first time that we saw the tree move. Number one, we were dealing with Billy's second or third generation copy. His original had already been stolen. But Wendell had like a sixth or seventh generation copy. And of course, the resolution was so bad, you couldn't see the tree move. So, again, going back to photography, this is one of the things you have to look for, and that's how many generations down are you dealing with?
You know, I should mention something here, Lee. We're talking about the beam ship footage. I know many of those in this audience have seen Contact from Pleiades, number one, and perhaps volume two. They both have been published by Genesis 3, which is your company. And now you are making available a 90-minute home cassette, video cassette, for the people, which includes the movie footage taken by Billy Meyer, plus interviews with Billy Meyer that the Japanese the group from Nippon Television took. And you were kind enough to send me my copy, which I value, as I did Volume 1 and Volume 2. And they are fantastic.
You know what's unique about that footage? Now, you have to remember, Bill, we sat on that for almost 5 years. Now, we sat on it during the time when our critics were saying that we didn't have any evidence. They were saying a lot of things. But, you know, as it is now, the timing is right. And we're now ready to release it so that the people can see what we've seen since 1978 to 79. And what's amazing about Beam Ship, the movie footage, is the fact there are 8 segments of movie footage that are all daylight. 1 segment of night footage. But in each segment of daylight footage, there's a different scene. There's a different situation. You have one where Meyer walks into the scene. The beam ship is hovering above. You have another, which is my favorite, and others, where this well-traveled highway, you see this beam ship hovering over. And you can count 4 different automobiles, automobile traffic that travels beneath the beam ship as it sort of just lumbers there silently, just hovering above. So it's amazing footage. We've never seen anything like this before.
Well, I was intrigued by the footage where the beam ship just in a twinkling changes positions. And then just disappears.
Which so is the Japanese.
Which is a part of the technology of the ship, as has been explained to us by Wendell. And I think you went into that with us one night. We also had an explanation given to us by Edwin Slade, who spent some time with Smith Rudy here about 6 weeks ago when he was with us. And there you can see in these tapes that actually happened. So you're making it available for home video consumption, VHS or Beta, huh?
Yes, yes we are. It's the only UFO, and we don't like to use that word UFO anymore.
And they're IFOs.
I think IFOs much better because they identify themselves. we are making it available to the public to let everybody decide for themselves whether this is a model or if it's for real. And I think that's the key thing to this whole case, because I think a certain percentage of the public will always feel that it's a hoax, and another percentage will always feel that it's real. We've seen these percentages work for 5 years now. And one of the reasons we're releasing this is you decide. In other words, after you see it, you decide. And that's all we're asking.
Well, one thing, it seems to me, for it to have been a hoax, that Billy Meyer, the little one-armed farmer in Switzerland, way outside of Zurich there, would have had to have been able to access special effects studios that are at least within range of what we have here in Hollywood. And there aren't any over there. So
and not only that, Bill, I mean, we're talking 10 years ago.
Right.
We're talking 1975 and 76 when he gathered most of the hard evidence. And, you know, a lot has happened since 1975 and 76. Today we can look at the shuttle, for example. We know that they're creating metals in space and crystals. So that's no biggie. But in 1975 it was. I mean, a cool fusion process for metal. Come on. And this is what blew the scientists away.
It was a cold rolled way of making an alloy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how or why we should do anything like that.
That's right.
There's some question about whether there was calcium in it or not.
There were traces. There was also thulium. And this, I think, really disturbed Vogel more than anything else. I just finished editing our next tape, and it's called Beamship the Metal, and we're releasing the metal analysis, and most of it is was footage taken at IBM when Vogel was with IBM in his laboratory there.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it is microscopy work combined with interview with Yowie. And it's fascinating because this first piece, Vogel remarks over and over, he cannot get over the purity of this material. Highly crystalline material in metal. Unheard of. Why would anybody want to do that?
And it was a great deal of lead and copper and brass and things that you wouldn't think would be in a flying machine, but all great conductors of electricity.
Yes.
Very fascinating stuff. And we have a lot more for it to go with you. We're just getting started on Open Mind tonight. With me is Lee Elders speaking to us from Alexandria, too. And Lee, I think they have the beamship tape there, in fact.
I think they do, yes.
And I don't think they could keep it because everybody wants to see it.
I hope so.
If you wanted to get it, what do you have to do? Can we buy them from you?
Well, one of the things now, we're getting so close to Christmas that we would suggest anyone wanting this tape or the metal tape, just write to us. We're in Arizona. Is it all right to give the address here, Bill?
Yeah, we're going to do it officially later, but you can go ahead and do it now.
Well, it's real simple. Just Genesis 3. Genesis is the distributor of the tape. Genesis 3, Post Office Box JJ, and that's Munns Park, Arizona, 86017. And we'll try to get it to you by Christmas. If you send us a check or a money order, either way.
What is it, 59 then?
59.95, yes. Uh-huh.
59.95. And we'll have those addresses for you as we go on. I thought we might take just a moment here, if you don't mind. You sent me a fascinating piece of audio tape. And I want to share the sounds of the spacecraft. And Lee, I'd like for you to set the scene of what we're going to listen to here.
Okay, the setting is 1982. The sound analysis is one of our last priorities, Bill. We had already been... Oh, we'd spent about 3 or 4 years on the photos.
But this is radio.
Pardon me?
I said, but this is radio, so
right.
The sound analysis is important to us.
Yes, and we finally got around to it in 82. There had been some preliminary work done by Delatoso and others, but in 82, we took it into Los Angeles to a laboratory there, and we had two gentlemen really look at it close on their equipment. And coming up, you will... probably hear my wife, Britt, she was present, and Wendell Stevens, and Steve Ambrose, and Niels Rognerud.
What lab was this?
This was Excalibur Studios in North Hollywood.
All right. So you're there, and is this just just sound tape you're working with that Billy Meyer had recorded.
Yes.
And
this is variation. This is the second tape that he had made. The first tape was about 40 minutes. It was on variation 2, The Craft. And this is on variation 6.
It's interesting, as this contact went along with Billy Meyer, that they kept coming up with new models of the spacecraft all the way through.
Well, you know, to an investigator, this has to blow you away, because every time we get this guy in one arena and think we had him surrounded, you know, like still photography, he would jump into another arena. He would take us there like sounds or metal.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a never-ending chase. So anyway, it was a fascinating experience, and coming up as this tape.
All right. I want to share this moment with you as you're listening to the investigators themselves, as well as sound engineers, dealing with the perplexing things that they are seeing on their scopes as they listen to the sounds of the Variation 6 Pleiadian spacecraft.
You got it.
What?
Scene 2, take 6.
Now, it's very random. You see, there are maybe 20 predominant pinks.
We just need some clean traffic.
Frequency components of the signal, and as we can see, it's changing both on top and bottom. The small instrument on the top here measures the main frequency component on the signal. At the moment, it's around 1,000 cycles per second, which is right in the middle of your voice spectrum. Now there we had a very pure tone, with very little added noise or other harmonics.
But it's still, it's an alignment of several tones. It's not as though it just, like, there's an alignment of
of maybe 10 different tones.
So 30s again. What's that? Okay. What does that mean?
Well, all of the spurious tones that you were getting before, all right, are tuning and aligning to the same frequency, or not exactly the same frequency, but near enough that they... It's not as though those different frequencies are falling out and one is coming through. They're aligning. You have it... See, it's... You understand what I'm...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as though maybe before you had 10 different frequencies at random, and then all of a sudden 9 dropped out and you only had 1 left. What's happening is the 10 different frequencies are converging on 1 simple frequency, which is, I find, very interesting, because...
Changes that you've got on the spectrum analyzer. What is it telling you?
Okay, let's pick a point here on the screen. Let's pick that point there. You see how the level of that point is changing, it's going up and down.
So you can see that there was a great deal of interest that was being demonstrated by the sound engineers as they heard these sounds that Billy Meyer recorded of the... Later. Mm-hmm.
But he said there certainly aren't any synthesizers that have oscillators that are that many, you know, and can be randomly tuned to that many different type of frequencies. Another thing is they found out that one frequency that remained stable throughout the entire testing was, well, they compared it to the Schumann resonance factor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a natural frequency of Mother Earth.
7.85.
Very interesting question.
A 7.85 hertz wave that stayed consistent all the way through.
Right.
And so it just kind of adds a little sauce for the goose here, doesn't it?
Well, there's something else, too, that I don't know if you're familiar with or not, and I'd like to get into it with you without naming names here. It is very sensitive information, but...
Can you hold that?
Sure. Be glad to.
Well, we take a little break at 15 minutes away from 10 o'clock on a Saturday.
Okay, in 1982, we did the analysis you just heard. In 1980, we shipped the sound tape of Variation 2 to a friend, Rob Shellman, who came to us in 1979 through APRO. Rob was in the Navy. He was stationed at a naval base on the East Coast. At this base, they had a computer where they carried what they call sound signatures within the computer. It was primarily used for identifying various sounds in the ocean, such as submarines. They ran these sounds through the computer. Now, this computer supposedly had sounds of everything in it. It couldn't match the sounds of Variation 2. We found this extremely interesting. Now, going back to your point, here we've got a one-armed man, handicapped, sixth grade education, handicap. And he, if he's hoaxing it, he's fooling us at every turn. Not only is he fooling us, but he's also fooling science.
He's fooling our most sophisticated computers.
Exactly.
Well, he is really quite a fellow, isn't he?
He is a great guy, warm human being. He's never been into this for personal gain. Now, you're talking to a man here that spent many hours with Billy Meyer, many days. Our whole investigative team spent almost 300 days living at the farmhouse over a period of 5 years. And we never detected any trickery. We never uncovered anything smacking of hoax.
Well, I think it's interesting in watching the tape that you are now making available to the public. Yowie does interviews Billy Meyer. And you walk with Yowie and Billy Meyer to the various locations there in Switzerland where so many of these sightings were made. And you just can't help but fall in love with him. He's so warm and he's so gentle and he is so real. And he seems a little bit perplexed why people are having difficulty in understanding what he's trying to tell them. You feel for him, you really do.
Well, that's what's amazing about the man. I'm not a UFO expert. I was never into UFOs prior to this case. Sure, I believed in them. I believed that other life was possible. But Intercept definitely was not a UFO investigative company. When we got involved with the Meyer case, as I say, for 2 years we tried to figure out how he was hoaxing it. But we finally gave up because it became easier and more practical to believe that it was actually happening than it was that he was hoaxing it. It would have required too much money, too many accomplices, too many unexplainable situations, such as the metal. How did he produce that? And other issues, so...
Well, I think the story of the hoax would be greater than the story of the content.
Oh, I agree, definitely.
The folks are beginning to line up on the phone. I know they have questions. I have found over the years, Lee, they're far better interrogators than I am.
Okay.
And I've just become a traffic cop. I know that there are questions about the Billy Meyer case. I'd like for you to kind of limit them with Lee, if you will, to the Billy Meyer case, what is being said there, the hard evidence. If you want to ask about the tape, certainly any of those things. We will play some more of the sound tape for you, so if you missed it the first time, get it the second time, get your tape recorders rolling as far as that goes. And we'll get to your calls in a second. Let me give you the number. Los Angeles, 5 ground still to cover about the Billy Meyer case, a contact case with people from Pleiades, and we have just the guy to answer those questions on the line. He's Lee Elders, and I believe we have Roger is up. Roger, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. The question I'd like to ask is, what book or what material is available as to the lessons that Billy Meyer received from these people as to what we should do on this earth to get ourselves out of our mess?
Good question, Roger.
That's a good question. There were some contact notes made of the case, but those have not been translated in their entirety as yet.
He did them in German, as I recall.
They're in Swiss German, yes. And some of them have been translated to English, but are not enough at this time to warrant a publication. Also, I might add that we're under contract now. There's an option on this material, and we cannot release anything for another 2 years. The reason? There is currently a mainstream book being written on the case, and it should be released within, 12, 14 months.
But it does go into, Roger, to answer your question, what the Pleiadians see as our plight. They have enormous suggestions for us and where we should be going, and it really starts at home.
Individual. Oh, sure.
Oh, sure, yes. That's the...
Each individual.
That's right. You'll find a very metaphysical ring to a lot of the things that they have to say.
Right.
And one of the key issues that we utilized in the movie footage video was the fact that Meyer was talking about balancing the material with the spiritual. And
yes.
If you really think about that, I think that's one of the key ingredients necessary today, is to try to balance those two.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Well, it does. I just was hoping there'd be something out now. Do you know of other sources, which have the same message probably from other ways? Because let's face it, this stuff's coming from a lot of different ways.
Oh, no question. I think there's a lot of individuals channeling various information.
Right.
I've heard of one up in the Seattle area. The name escapes me. They're channeling information on how to help this planet,
Help
mankind. I think that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Of what this whole thing's about.
Sure it is.
We're in trouble. This planet's in trouble. We know this. Now, what can we do about it? Not what can they do about it. What can we do?
No, we've got to do it ourselves.
Right. That's you're absolutely correct.
Well, it's good to hear this, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Roger, appreciate you getting in on that. And we have time to get you started, Bob. Go right ahead.
Okay, Bill, thank you. I have a question for Lee. It has to do with the beam ship video.
Yes.
An hour into the, by the way, which was quite excellent, and I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, did you see it?
Pardon me?
I say, do you have a copy?
Yes, I do, Lee. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
An hour into the video, you showed a tree that was struck by a laser, and shortly thereafter, Billy Meyer mentioned a cosmonaut by the name of Minora.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember this name?
Yes.
What can you tell me about this cosmonaut Minora, if anything? I have a real personal, real good reason for asking. And,
Okay. there is our music. You want to hang on
sure.
on the line there, Bob, while... Mm-hmm. We all go get a cup of coffee and have a break. We've got a couple of hours more to go to discuss the people from Pleiades who have been cavorting with one Billy Meyer. And with us to talk about that is Lee Elders from Arizona, the chief investigator on that particular case. A lot of new thinkings, and we're here to stretch yours just a little bit to give you some more information about the UFO. Maybe you'll think a little more seriously about it. You listened to Paul Harvey today. You found out that a recent poll said that over 100 million Americans believed in UFOs. Everybody seems to, but the federal government. And with us is Lee Elders to talk about that. Lee, you were talking to Bob whenever we took our little break there. Bob, you two continue.
Yes, thank you, Bill. Yes, Lee, as I mentioned, I was asking about the cosmonaut Menorah.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm asking is, and bear with me, I'm going to agree this is hard to swallow. I met with her out of body 3 years ago. And she introduced herself.
You went out of body, Bob?
Everybody in Los Angeles
goes.
Actually, there's quite a bit to it, but I'll keep it real short and real simple. And I met with her in Switzerland, out of body. She introduced herself as Menorah. At the time, though, I thought she said Mora, but after I saw your video, I realized it was Menorah. And we had a conversation and she even had an assistant and an android with her. But she didn't tell me anything about herself. I was wondering, spending 3 years with Billy Myers, or 5 years, can you share any insight with me?
We know very little about Menorah, also Playa. That was another one mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I'm not positive, because there's very little mentioned about her, but I do believe that she was or is a Lyrian cosmonaut. She was not from the Pleiades.
Mm-hmm.
Meyer claims to have had several different contacts with various civilizations, Pleiades being one,
mm-hmm.
the Dals, that's spelled D-A-L-S, mm-hmm. being another. They sort of prepped him for his plating experience 10 years prior,
mm.
and then the Lyrians. Now, I might add that these are some of the reasons that the so-called UFO experts back in 1978 felt the case was a hoax. There was just too much to it. There were too many, you know, outside stories, too many contacts with other civilizations. If he could have held it to the Pleiadians, it would have made life a lot easier for the investigators, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when Edwin Slade was over there, he came back with a fascinating story, Lee. I don't know whether I've even had a chance to pass it on to you, but he was talking to the hands that work around there. They showed him footprints. It seems to be sort of a way station now, and some of the people that come down and spend a while are very large, and some are very small.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that the word is out that this is sort of a safe place that they can come.
Well, you know, we entertained this idea back in 78 and 79 when we were faced with these facts. Now, obviously, we were searching for some kind of rational explanation. I mean, nowhere in the history of ufology has an individual had so many contacts over a period of time with different societies. And one of the things that we were checking into at that period of time was the fact that there might be, in this area, meaning in the Schmidruti area of Switzerland, maybe some kind of time warp in that place, something like the Bermuda Triangle, that would create this type of situation. In other words, it might be a beacon area for various spacecraft coming into our civilization. And therefore, maybe Myers in that cosmic phone book. Who knows?
Hmm. Yeah, Bill, if I can just say one thing, I'm sure there's a few viewers out there that...
Well, if they are, this is really the open mic.
like I was going to say, I'm sure there are some out there that obviously just can't accept with what I just said. I will say this. The android that was with her, I watched this android burn a circle in my nail, and when I came back to my body... The circle was in my nail.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand. He burned a what?
A circle.
A circle.
A perfect circle in my fingernail.
In your fingernail.
And I actually felt the pain out of body.
That's unusual.
Yeah, highly unusual. And when even more unusual, when I returned to my body, the circle was there.
That's very unusual.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a copy of the old Wendell Stevens book?
Of UFO Pleiades?
It was like his diary. He only published a small number of them.
The green books.
The green ones. No,
this
I don't.
UFO contact from Pleiades investigative summary.
Well, I don't have the summary. I have the hardcover.
Okay, you don't have the preliminary investigation report.
No, I'd love to have it.
Well, it's impossible to find anymore. It's like Volume 1. It's history, and they're now collector's items. But it's very... let me share one thing with you that you might find intriguing.
Please.
We have seen a photograph. We've never released it. We've never published it. On board, supposedly taken by Meyer, on board the mothership, there are two cosmonauts, both female. One is Ascot, and the other... I'm not sure if it's Playa or Monera at this point, but standing off to the right is an android.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe this android to me, since you have not seen this photograph?
Okay, well, I'll tell you quite honestly, usually whenever you're out of body, you can see just as clear as in body. However, when I met with them, they came to me as a silhouette. Minora, this android, and her assistants came to me. Although I could see the farm where the ship landed, I could see the fence, I could see everything else perfectly clear. I can even see the bench where we sat on. I can even see the clipboard she had in her hand when she was speaking to me.
Let me ask you another question, real quick.
Mm-hmm.
What do you estimate the size, height, of the android was?
Okay, approximately 6.5 feet, 7 feet, no more than 7, I would say.
Taller than she was?
Yes. Yes.
Cylindrical?
No.
Cylindrical is the word, I guess.
Yes. Okay.
Arms and legs or R2-D2?
No. Arms and legs. As a matter of fact, when I walked up to this android, my arm went up automatically. I had no control over that. His arm raised. He grabbed the tip of my nail. That's when I felt the pain. That's when I said to myself, you can't do this to me. It was like talking to a machine. He didn't even listen to me whatsoever. I sat down with Minora. We had a conversation which would blow your mind. And she got up, went back to her ship, and I tried to take control of the situation, and I was back in my body.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a mind blower. And it happened, as a matter of fact, this February will be 3-year anniversary, February 9th.
How does that stack up with the android in the picture?
I'd prefer to discuss that in private with this gentleman. Why don't you drop me a letter, and we'll talk about it.
Okay.
And this way we can move on with some
I understand.
Cards.
Okay, you want to give him the address, Lee?
Oh, yeah, that's Post Office Drawer or Box JJ.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Genesis 3, Roman numeral 3.
Mm-hmm.
P.O. Drawer JJ, Munds Park, that's M-U-N-D-S, Park, Arizona, 86017.
Wonderful. Just out of curiosity, real quickly, do you know Billy Meyer's birthday?
Yes.
Is it in February?
Yes.
February 9th?
No, February 3rd.
The 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting because, real quick, all this didn't happen in one night. It happened over 4 consecutive nights, and it started on the 4th. So I don't know if there's anything to that, but I thought I'd ask.
Well, I'm glad you did. It's very intriguing. I'd like to talk to you more about it.
Very well.
Okay.
Thank you,
Lee. All right, Bob. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And in case you missed that address, I'm going to give it to you here officially in just a second. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Lee Elders. World. They claim to be from Pleiades. The hard evidence involved. And here's how you can get your own movie footage of the whole thing. So I want you to listen carefully. You know, the very first Open Mind program back in 1979 dealt with the amazing ongoing experience of Billy Meyer, a man who, since 1975, had been having a number of visits from female astronauts from a planet in Pleiades. Well, his story was backed up with hundreds of photographs and movie footage of their craft. Now, you have an opportunity to see that movie footage taken by Billy Meyer himself. The investigators of this amazing case are making a 90-minute home videotape available to you for the first time with a pictorial insight into the man Billy Meyer, an actual footage of the craft. This footage was first seen by 30 million people on Nippon Television, and now you can see it at home. Get your copy by sending a check or money order for $59.95, postage and handling included, to Genesis 3 Publishing, Post Office Drawer JJ, Munns Park, Arizona, 86017. Now stipulate beta or VHS and allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery. That's $59.95 to Genesis 3, P.O. Drawer, J.J., Munns Park, Arizona, 86017. Come aboard, Chuck.
Good evening, darling. good evening, Lee.
Hi, Chuck.
I'm barely getting you, but I guess I can't hear you. Good evening, Bill.
Okay.
You know, I've had experience with some what they call evoked potentials with the brain, okay? And that has to do with hitting the brain with, say, a flash of light or a sound and measuring the response to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then I was listening to those sounds, you know, the sounds of the motors. And, Bill, you brought up the 7.85 or 7.83 hertz
mm-hmm.
as being always present in those sounds. And then I've had a past experience with, say, with past life regression where I was in a cockpit and seeing that going on. But, see, it didn't hit me until later on that that the UFOs are totally mentally controlled. And that those sounds you were hearing were really were upper harmonics or higher harmonics of just brain waves. And that when they correlate, that means there is agreement that that's what the pilot wants to happen at that moment. You see? And if you do that if you take the same analogy with human beings, is that at times when they recognize something that is being real at the moment, you can see it peek up on a computer as being rep, that's it. And there's no way you can get around it. You see what I'm saying? The analogy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. There's been some talk among those who have studied the strange characteristics and the propulsion systems of these and other craft that there could very well be a form of mental control. I think we've even talked about that, Lee.
Oh, yes.
Lee, how do you feel about the interdimensionality of the mind itself? If I say that I want to be on a Pleiades in the next 10 seconds, and if I'm in a machine, if I'm in a ship that operates in that realm of intention, what's to keep me from going there?
Hello?
What's to keep me from going there?
Well, it takes them 5 minutes. I don't know. with the new beam ships.
Well, if they can think in concert, in unison, which they can, if they are adept in telepathy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's always been Mr. Delatosa's theory, who's worked very diligently on this project in science for many years, that there's a combination there of thought. In other words, thought is required for hyperspace, okay? Thought in unison.
Coherent thought is in hyperspace. I'm saying that that is the domain.
But what I'm saying is before they jump, the spacecraft jumps to hyperspace,
uh-huh.
It requires total unison of thought between all the crew.
I see.
Okay, and the onboard ship computers.
Right.
Okay. Now, do you follow me?
Sure.
If you want to go beyond that, you'll have to talk to Delatosa, okay?
Well, no, I won't need to go.
Huh? Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Uh-huh.
You could very well be on it. And further than that, Chuck, we're looking at some of the other sciences that we're dealing with now, particularly whenever we move into this rarefied air known as scalar interferometry.
Uh-huh.
And some of the things that happens there, a great deal depends upon the operator. And when I
talk about quantum physics says that the observer is part of the process.
That's right. And as these sciences now get more pristine and more exacting, we see the great interrelation between physics and the physics of the human mind.
And that the message of the Pleiadians is that we are the process, we are the environment, and it's not out there, and that we've got to straighten it out.
Well, they sure have a lot to say about straightening it out, don't they?
Right. Okay, Bill, I just wanted to bring that up to see, you know, make it more mystical.
Well, it's not mystical. I like to see it get down to science, and you're really touching on some touchstones of the advanced scientific community right now.
Right.
All right, Chuck, thank you for that input. Appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, Edson, you're on.
Hi, good evening.
How are you?
How are you? How are you, gentlemen? By the way, Bill, I too have had all the body experiences. Okay, I don't control them. They only happen during very severe emotional times, but if you look at...
Hope you have no more.
Well, I hope not, but I'll just briefly mention in the... Omni magazine for December, there's a gentleman in Poland who claims that out-of-body experiences and when you come back after death?
A near-death experience.
Near-death experience are related, so...
Yes, they are. They're very closely related.
Mm-hmm, floating and so forth. What I want to ask is, first, has any ultra or infrasonic frequencies been discovered in these tapes of Billy Myers?
What type of frequencies did you ask?
Ultrasonic or infrasonic?
At this point in time, no. Although I think it would be best to probably put you in touch with one of the gentlemen that did the work on this. But I don't think there has. But an update on it, I'd be glad to answer that if you want to send me a letter.
Okay. And you were mentioning something about a beacon there in this spot in Switzerland. I suppose Switzerland is surrounded by mountains and Alps and so forth. If I remember correctly, Baron von Reichenbach, who's the discoverer of the Odic force and using crystals to detect this force, obtained these crystals from the Alps, and I think some of them were 6, 8, 10 feet long, so maybe that has something to do with it.
That could be.
Yeah.
We've also heard, for example, the continental shelf, which I think appears right on the border of New Mexico and Arizona, has been very heavy in UFO activity. I don't know if the shelf is a curiosity point for them, or if it has something to do with electromagnetic waves, or what. It's an interesting analogy, though.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps there's something like this in the Swiss area. We don't
know. Speaking of the UFO air activity down there, I got clippings from Tucson newspapers an event there of, 3 or 4 weeks ago where flights of 60 UFOs were observed for an hour and a half by air controllers, radar, thousands of people in the Tucson area. There they were. Now, they will not talk about it at the flight tower there at the airport. I tried to talk to someone about it. They have been hushed up, but they were seen. They were reported, well reported, everywhere except in Los Angeles. But the folks of Tucson had quite a show. They weren't balloons. They were readily watched on military and civilian radar.
Bill, I was with Wendell about 3 weeks ago. We spent several hours together, and he told me that the following evening after this major flap over Tucson, and I've heard there were, 4 waves of 15 apiece or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Staggered in between one another. But he told me the following evening, the same formation, the same number was sighted over the Burbank area and Santa Monica area.
Well,
have you heard anything about that?
I hadn't heard anything about the local flap at all. Obviously, I didn't see it, or I'd have been on the radio quite with that, and I carry my video camera with me everywhere I go, and would have gotten some footage. But it's interesting to me how legitimate news media, whenever they have a really incredible, well, I hate to use the word incredible because that means not to be believed, but astounding story like this. I think footage was shown on television in Tucson.
And also Phoenix.
And Phoenix. But the great editors of Los Angeles were not interested in that story. It's much better to have a wreck on the freeway on the tube.
Well, you know, Cora Lorenzen called it, she was interviewed by the local television station, one of them. She called it one of the greatest flaps of all time. That probably is. Because she said it was a whole revolutionary new, pioneering phase for sightings.
Well, it's similar to the sightings of last summer up in northern New York, although those were nighttime sightings, but thousands of people saw that. And again, wrecks on the freeway were far more important to our newspapers and television stations. Okay, Edson, appreciate those questions a great deal.
Thank you very much.
I'm Bill Jenkins talking with Lee Elders tonight. We're talking about the Billy Meyer case. And it is on the line. Wilfred, welcome aboard.
Hello there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really into these UFO stuff, but...
Okay.
One day I got into your show, one night I remember, and I heard you talking about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested about this case. I just want to know if you're going to talk about more of other UFO cases.
Well, tonight, because we have the chief investigator on this particular case on, we'll limit it to that because, as Lee pointed out earlier, he's not into UFOs either, other than this case. Do you have something that you want to know? Maybe I can help you.
Yes. Could you tell me when would you be talking more about UFOs?
UFOs in general?
Yes.
The other cases that are around? It'll probably be in March, March or April, somewhere along there.
Okay.
All right.
How would I get to know? You'll tell it in your show, right?
Excuse me?
You'll say it in your show.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to know that.
All right.
If you can, you'll say something about in general.
Right.
The show.
Yeah. Is there anything in general you'd like to know, though, right now?
Well, I'm not really into that stuff now. I'm kind of a novice right now.
Okay. Well, this
I don't really know, so I won't waste your time.
This is one of the most fascinating of all of the cases, Wilfred, if you're interested, so you're invited to stay right along with us, okay?
Okay, thank you.
You betcha. And Bob, you're on.
Oh, hi, Lee?
Yes.
Hi, I don't know if you can hear me too well. I can't hear you too well.
Oh, you're both coming in fine.
Okay. I've had considerable difficulty locating Volume 1. I thought, I think, around December of 81 for the first time in a bookstore. Never saw it after that, but it piqued my curiosity. I looked for it. I had people look in books and print and microfilm, B. Dalton, that sort of thing. Nobody could find it. I finally, 2 years later, found one defective copy in a bookstore in Thousand Oaks. And I was wondering, is there any type of government, interference, or have you been approached by anyone in the government as far as publishing such a remarkable story and photographs?
Okay, I think that's a two- or three-part answer there. First of all, Volume 1 is out of print, has been since 81. Let me go back to Volume 1. The reason we published it, Genesis 3 was set up, organized, and everything with the investigators of this case. When we got involved, we found that the expenses of investigating this case in Switzerland became astronomical. We were in the six figures. Now, that's the most. We've spent more money investigating this case than any, I think, 10 other UFO cases in the history of UFOlogy. So we had to come up with a solution to finance this investigation. And the solution came about through Volume 1. And the investigators set up Genesis 3. We published Volume 1 as an overview of the case. And we felt, well, we'll be lucky if we sell a couple of thousand. Maybe we can offset some of these tremendous expenses. Instead, it became an occult classic. They found that we have no idea.
I'd like to know where mine is. However, the beam ship videotape.
Yes.
I think surpasses Volume 1, and it probably will be a classic unto itself as well. Because, Bob, you'll not only get to see the pictures that are in Volume 1, or many of them, but you'll also get to see the movie footage.
That's another thing. I was curious as to why this case, as explicit as it is in its evidence, is not been detailed at all, like in the book by Fawcett and Greenwood, Clear Intent.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's even mentioned a word of it in there, even in passing. And it seems so remarkable. It's almost as if I've showed people and they look at me like, that's incredible, but is it for real?
I think one of the reasons is that Larry Fawcett, for instance, just doesn't have the hard evidence at his disposal, so it would be sort of improper for him to make too much comment about it.
Oh. Well, let me ask you this. Volume 2, is it going to be as hard to find as Volume 1 has been?
There are limited quantities left of Volume 2, but if you write the address, it's been given several times
right.
On the show.
Go ahead and give it again.
Okay, it's Post Office Drawer JJ, Munns Park, Arizona. Address it to Genesis 3, Roman numeral 3, Munns Park, Arizona, P.O. Box JJ, 86017. And we'll try to find a copy for you.
Thanks very much.
Of those copies left.
And
as I said earlier, we are barred, or I should say, these two books are under auction right now from New York, and we cannot reprint them.
Oh.
And the reason we can't is because there's a mainstream book being written as we talk on this case. It'll be out in about 12, 14 months. So as courtesy to the writer and the publisher, we've agreed not to compete against this book with Volume 1 or 2, so we will be holding it back for 2 or 3 years.
Can you give any clue as to the name or the publisher of this book?
I can't get into that now.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks a lot.
Well, if you can get volume two, you'll be very happy with it.
I'll
keep mine under lock and key.
The one I got is a publisher's defect. It's put, a couple of the sections are upside down, but I bought it anyway because it's the only thing I could find after 2 years. And it's somewhat of a collector's item on top of that.
Well, volume two is just as excellent, and the picture and the photography, it answers a lot of the questions that were unanswered in volume one.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
All right, Bob.
Bye-bye.
And we have another Bob on the line. Bob, welcome aboard. There you are, Bob.
Yes.
I hit the wrong button.
Yes, hi. I was wondering about this recent flap. About 6 weeks ago, I was outside about 2 a.m., and I saw a flight of three oval objects over the San Gabriel Mountains. I live in Pasadena.
Now, this is 3 weeks ago?
About 6 weeks ago. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, you know, they came right over my house. What was I doing sleeping?
I've never seen anything. They were in absolutely strict formation, perfectly spaced out from each other. There were three of them. And they held this formation and skimmed right over Mount Wilson. And you could see them passing in front of portions of the mountain, but actually moving through a cloud layer. There were some scattered clouds.
You say they were oval objects?
They were oval, and they were completely white.
And this was nighttime?
And it was 2 a.m., so yeah, they were illuminated from inside, it looked like streetlights almost, but they were flying.
Were they windows or just an orb of light?
The whole shape was lit, was glowing. Very definite oval form. And no sound whatsoever that I could hear at this distance. They must have been about 2.5 to 3 miles away from me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very strange, because I never had seen anything like that before, in this area at least.
Well, there has been an increase in sighting activity in Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, this area.
I was wondering also in the films, are there situations where you can see part of the landscape behind the object and portions in front? That's what this situation was like.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because I know I've done a lot of films myself with miniatures, and the hardest thing to do is to put a large or a living object like a person or a large moving tree or something like that in front of something that's small. That's where you really get into problems.
Yeah, the perspective, whenever you really start analyzing the perspective of the craft as it moves toward you and then back, you know you're not dealing with a model.
And also shadows. Do you ever see shadows, interplay of the shadows from the vehicle on the ground or on the people in,
yes, you do.
In the scene? Because I know that's another area where things can get very difficult.
Well, you know, Bill, if I could interject one thing here, a story we've heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but if you ever get a chance to talk to Spielberg, it might be worth asking him this, but when he was shooting Close Encounters, we heard that they had spent a lot of money trying to get a daylight scene that looked real with a UFO, and they finally gave up after a large dollar amount. And that's why in that film, all the scenes are night footage, or, you know, or at nighttime. And so, anyway, at that period of time, this is back, I think it was 78, 79, the studio contacted Mr. Tom Welch. If you ever have Tom on the line, Bill,
yes,
have him tell you this story. But he and Wendell met with the studio heads over there, and they asked one question. They said, hey, we'll pay Meyer. We'll pay him six, seven figures if he'll just tell us how he's doing it. I was sitting in Switzerland at the time with Billy in his living room. The phone rang. And now this is the studio corporate headquarters calling, and Wendell and Tom are there. They're with three of the top executives, and the question to me to ask Billy was, how do you do it? I asked him, I said, look, now, Billy, answer this properly, because, you know, you can send your kids to Switzerland, you know, to a private Swiss school here with the type of money they're talking about. So just be honest, how do you do it? He thought for a minute, and he said, well, just tell him it just happens. And that was his answer, so I repeated it to Tom, who repeated it to the executive, and that was the end of that story. But this actually happened. Now, the Spielberg thing, I don't know, but we heard that story.
Uh-huh.
So, you'll find it quite fascinating to look at the footage yourself if you...
Yes, I really would like to, because having shot a lot of this kind of thing with small-scale models, I would have a pretty good idea right away of what I was seeing.
Okay?
Yeah, okay.
All right, Bob, thank you very much for your input. Mm-hmm. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Me? The reason I'm calling is... I heard the...
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Oh, is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
The reason I'm calling is that I heard the recorded sound of the ship.
We'll do that again also and give you some more of it.
Okay. The thing that kind of interested me was the fundamental frequency. I believe you said 7.85 hertz.
Right in that area, the Earth resonance, I guess it's generally known as, or the Schumann resonance.
Now, is that the electrical resonance?
No, that's a sound. It's one we can't hear.
It's natural, Bill.
It's a natural resonance of the Earth.
It's the natural electromagnetic resonance of Earth. It was discovered by Nikola Tesla.
Right, right.
Okay? And it's it varies. Well, his was at 6.6 cycles. Then Schumann came in, discovered a second resonance of 7.8 cycles per second.
So you are saying this is an electrical resonance?
Well, it would be, it would be an electromagnetic resonance. It's one of the dangerous resonances, actually, that is involved with the woodpecker sounds that are being broadcast into the Soviet Union, from the Soviet Union to us.
Well, let me ask you, Lee, what significance, with your research and stuff like that, what kind of significance do you, attribute to that very low frequency?
Could you repeat that, Bill? I can't hear.
He wanted to know what significance you attribute to the fact that the consistent frequency that is coming up on the scopes is that very low frequency of 7.885.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I'm not really qualified to get into this, but basically, as a real vague overview, there are a lot of theories. There's a gentleman down in New Zealand, I think, by the name of... the name escapes me right now, but he's done a lot of work in... that area, but a lot of people feel that the spacecraft are using electromagnetic grid points for their grounding, if we want to call that, so they can ground into this, I don't know if atmosphere is the right word or not.
Magnetic lines of energy. They seem to have a floating effect at some times, as if they are riding these undulating magnetic waves.
I think I've read about something like this. Isn't there a guy in Florida who has written a book dealing with this grid system covering the Earth?
Got me.
I don't know. The man in New Zealand, his name escapes me, but he's done some work in Harmonics 33 and several other books.
Well, maybe it's the same guy. I thought it was from Florida.
Gentlemen, I hope you can get him on your show some night. It would really be interesting to talk to Bill, and that's David Froning, right over in your area in Pacific Palisades.
David Froning?
David Froning, and he is very knowledgeable in this area, and he's got a lot of theories, and he's done a lot of work, and he's followed the Meyer case for about 5 years now.
If
you can get him, it would be an interesting show.
I'm always looking for interesting shows.
One further question, please. You know that the sound that you played over the radio,
mm-hmm.
was that of a ship hovering?
I didn't hear that.
Was the sounds that we played, was the ship hovering? I suspect it was more or less moving around a little bit, but within range of where Billy was recording.
Yes. There's an interesting story behind that recording. Not only was Billy recording, but also his wife, Poppy, was recording. The kids were there. There were three or four other people there. They never saw the ship. The ship never materialized during the recording. And the recording is like 30 to 5, 40 minutes long. Billy was approximately 150 yards away from his wife. They were separated. Each had a tape recorder, and each recorded the sound. And the witnesses told us, and... we really cross-examined them over a period of days, but they told us they never saw the ship, number one. Number two, what amazed them was there was really no source. I mean, they could not get out of range from it. It seemed like it was everywhere, all-encompassing. If they moved to the right, it was still there. If they moved to the left, it was still there.
It seems I recall Wendell telling us one evening that some of the people from the nearby village all started coming up because they were
yes.
there, too.
Yes, that's very true. The sound was heard at a great distance. I think it was like a half mile away. And people from other villages, farmers working in the field heard it, and they came to the source, but no one ever saw anything, and that's what was amazing.
Well, it sounds pretty fascinating.
But after you see beam shift, though, the movie footage, it's not really that amazing, because when that ship dematerializes...
Right in front of you.
Right in front of you, and you can see almost like a light shift occur, whereas the scenery, it's almost like an umbrella appears above the craft and bends light away from the scene, because the scene under and around the area where the ship is hovering becomes much darker.
And it also does have this very same phenomena. The shift in light happens just before it reappears.
Yes.
A 30th of a second or something, or 3/10 of a second. There is a consistency in the time of that.
It's 3/20, Bill, 3/20 of a second, and it's prior and after. It's prior to the dematerialization and after it rematerializes.
That's being looked at very carefully right now by John Bedini and Tom Bearden and some of the other people I know who understand those things. They have an explanation, by the way.
I'd love to hear it.
It's rather involved, but I want you to hear it when you get into town.
I would love to, and I'd love David Froning to hear that, too.
Okay, does that help you?
One more thing.
Okay.
What was the name of the tape again?
The name of the tape.
Beam Shift, the movie footage. We're calling the whole trilogy. We're producing a trilogy of approximately 4 hours
uh-huh.
on this case. And what we're doing is editing down 12 hours of footage shot by NTV in 79 and 80 into a four-hour trilogy. And we call it the Beam Shift Trilogy, and the first tape produced is Beam Shift the Movie Footage, and the second is Beam Shift the Metal, and it'll be available here in about 5 days.
Now, when you say beam ship, that's like B-E-A-M?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what they call the ship, so
right.
We can't figure any reason why we should call them anything else.
And I like it much better than UFO or flying saucers or alien encounters. Has a nice ring to it, and that's what they refer to their ships as.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we have Edward on the line.
Good evening.
Hello, Edward.
Good evening, Bill, and good evening, Lee.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you don't hear my heart, because I'm so excited that you finally have somebody I can really get into. And Lee, welcome.
Well, thank you.
I've been in contact with Genesis Lee since 1980, and I have both volumes of the photo journals. And,
you have both volumes, then?
Yeah, low
number
one. I have low serial numbers, too. And I also have the tape, which I just received a couple of weeks ago.
Hold it, Edward, because I've got a little something I've got to do.
Sure.
And then you can have it, Lee, here as a...
Okay, Lee, Bill said that he could never take anyone with him as close as he could get to the spacecraft, and so they had to stay behind. In the Beam Ship movie, there's a sequence where he goes up into the mountain and he sits down and you see the beam ship in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be movement of the camera. It looks like, I can't remember right now, but it's either a widening of the zoom or a close-up or whatever.
Okay, yes. What is occurring at that point is the Japanese film crew, they are zooming in, not Billy, not his camera. Okay.
They were taking pictures of Billy's movie projector.
Yes, I was aware of that, but it seems to me that what I'm referring to actually occurred in the actual footage, not the footage that the Japanese were doing. But that's okay. I can accept that because while I had the books, there was always a doubt in the back of my head about the reality of this thing. After I got the beam ship footage, I said, this is it. This is for real.
Do you really feel that way about that footage?
Well, I have an RCA VCR.
Yes.
And it has a special effect at the top of the line. So
yes.
I'm able to not only put it in slow motion, but I can slow it down even more.
Good.
And what happens is, when the beam ship disappears in a few sequences,
right.
I can slow the tape down so that when it reappears slowly as a point of light that gets brighter, as opposed to just coming on, you know, which would indicate to people that it would be a fake whatever. Here is proof that this thing is originating out of nowhere.
Now you understand why we release this tape.
Yes, it's great.
It's obvious it's not a cut film clip, isn't it?
No, that's what I'm trying to say, that it is not, that it is one straight sequence. And, of course, the darkening of the area's green trees and the grass and all that, that's mind-blowing. This is mind-blowing. What is happening here?
Let me ask you a question. On the scene, in the scene, where the ship jumps from the top of the screen to the bottom.
Right.
Okay, right above the knoll. Have you slowed that down?
Yeah, definitely. I've looked at that a million times.
Oh,
super slow motion.
Then you actually see that ship materialize in two stages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good.
Yes, I can confirm that. Yes. I'm not a professional photographer, although I'm a professional quality photographer, and I do know when somebody's faking something or when they're not, and at least the beam ship footage is for real. I can do without all the other before and after. Just the footage of the spaceship. That's worth the $60.
Okay. Well, I'm glad
by the way,
you know.
I'd like to pass this on to all those who are listening. The book, UFO Contact from the Pleiades, a Preliminary Investigation Report, is available. It is advertised in the October issue of Fate magazine on page 19. America West Distributors in Aurora, Colorado is selling it. It's the original book, by the way, with the original cover. I have a friend who has the original one.
Well, I had a friend call over to Colonel Stevens' residence where his daughter is, and they were trying to order some of these books, and they said they were out. There were no more, so...
Oh, well, I was possibly one of the first ones to order then, and I got real fast service, just like I always get good, great service from you and Genesis 3.
Uh-huh. When did you order it?
The book, I ordered it at the beginning of October, and I got it a couple of weeks later.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as I got the Fate issue, right at the end of September or the beginning of October, that's when I saw it.
I think it's out now. I mean, I think they're out of copies now, but anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate your call on Beamship the movie.
Yeah. And
there's
one
thing you've done, Edward.
Yes.
I know my wife is not going to appreciate you, because now I'm going to have to get me one of those gizmos on my VCR that slows things down.
Oh, yes, for sure. Always a top model. Never go for anything less. And by the way, your wife is going to be in company of Potsy and what's his name? The guy with the alien bases on the moon. None of them like me either. I can always tell a fake when I see one. Thank you very much, Lee. I hope that more comes from your end and... let's have more, yeah.
Yeah, order the metal tape. You'll really like that as well.
Okay, you'll see my check soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And thank you, Bill.
All right, Edward, thank you for contributing like that. Maureen, you're on. We have just about a minute, but let's get it started with you anyway.
Okay, great, thanks. Well, to start out with, I wanted to share with you that I've really enjoyed the opportunity of reading the material about the Pleiades. We have both of the books. And we have a very good friend who spent quite a bit of time in Switzerland with Billy.
Oh, really?
And out of her visit there, a number of questions came up, and I thought maybe we might be able to address some of them for us.
Okay. Start firing. I'll tell you when you have to stop.
Okay. Well, the first one is that when she was there in Switzerland, there were lots and lots and lots of pictures available that haven't been seen previously in the book, and also many manuscripts. Primarily in German. And we're a little curious as to why those haven't been made available at this time, or up until now.
Did you hear that, Lee?
I heard part of it. Something about there were many more pictures or...
Well, oh, there's our little thing.
Okay.
The question, let me put it to you quickly. There were pictures that haven't been seen over here whenever she visited Billy. And, of course, she saw a lot of the German manuscripts, and she wondered why they're not available in English. And there's a good answer for those, Maureen. If you want to hang on the line while we take a break for news, we'll get back to Lee after that.
Okay.
We're talking about the astronauts from Pleiades, photographs and the hard evidence that they do exist as it comes from Billy Meyer. So stay with us. Been a prolific writer, and some of the photographs that were available over there, they haven't seemed to be available over here.
Okay, well, Maureen, you've just brought up a question that is one of the reasons many of us do believe that this case is real, and that's because there is so much information on it. Now, when we got involved, we had to set up priorities, and these priorities involved, thus far, have involved two books that were published, two Japanese television specials that have aired, a documentary film that still hasn't been released, but will be, hopefully, soon. And other things, and a mainstream book in the works now. So we have just, we've had to take it by the numbers, and if that answers your question, with this new direction we're taking of releasing this material in stages, eventually we'll get to this, hopefully.
Great, Lee, I understand. Well, that actually brings up one other question, which is, when my friend was over there, she had long discussions with Billy, and he kept saying, why don't the people in the United States know about my book? Why don't they know about my material? Have they forgotten about me? And it seems to appear that Billy doesn't realize financially or in any other way, I mean, consciously, that we know about his books, that we're aware of what he's doing here in the United States. Is there something that happened with the rights of the book or something where he doesn't, he is not participating in this, or he doesn't realize
no,
what's
no.
happening?
I would have to question your friend's information there, because Billy has been informed all the way through. When you see the Beam Ship series, you'll see that he's in this film all the way.
Mm-hmm.
He has received various monies for his share of the rights. We have made arrangements to take care of him in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's been estimated that over 200 to 300 million people are aware of this case. Case in point, the Japanese special played to roughly 30 million people alone.
I think that's quite interesting in itself, Lee, that the Japanese did a special on Billy Meier and turned in an audience in Japan of 30 million.
Exactly.
Now, for some reason or another, the great minds at ABC and CBS and NBC don't think this is much of a story. Of course, you can look at what they put on the air that they think are good stories and understand, I suppose.
Right. Well, when the PM segment ran, Bill, in 1980, that was 7 minutes. Remember PM Magazine when
yes,
it was
mm-hmm.
on? Nacon, a TV station out of Tucson, KOLD, went to Wendell, asked if they could film 7 minutes. We agreed. They shot 7 minutes. The major, I guess the home office, whatever you want to call it, out of San Francisco, they picked it up. It played to 50 markets. Estimated 35 million people saw this in this country. It was so well received that PM came back to us in 1981 and asked for rerun privileges. It was the most sought after special they had done in 1980, and we granted this. So there are a lot of people aware of the Meier case, and I'd have to say that I don't think your friend is being very honest with this situation, because I just got a letter from Billy last week. He's in fine spirits. He's very happy. He's excited about everything. He's very much aware of everything going on, and he's not upset with us or anybody else connected with this program.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that, actually. Well, there's a couple of other things that I was curious about. I have heard something about a movie script and some rights to a movie script that possibly went over to Universal at one time based on the material. Are you aware of any of that?
Bill, could you repeat it? I can barely hear.
She was asking about that first movie that was made that went over to Universal for a while and then it's kind of floated around.
Oh, that's, yes, I'm very much aware of that. I'm very much aware of the writer. In fact, in 1978, I took this writer and three other people. I will not mention their names at this point. One of them today is number two man at a major television network in the documentary division, but I escorted the four of them into Switzerland. They met Meier, and then I understand a script was done, but it was never sold. And I understand that every now and then we get a drift that somebody's looking at it, but nothing has ever been done on it, as far as I know.
Lee, the other thing I was wondering about is, I know that it seems as if, maybe it's not actually so, but it seems as if sometimes that we are suppressing a lot of this information and trying to keep it out of the public's eye. And I was wondering if Wendell's having been in jail might have anything to do with that suppression of information.
Well, that's a question I'd rather not get into, Marie, if you don't mind. I think that's something that Wendell should answer, not myself.
Okay, I understand. And the last thing I was curious about is, have you had contact yourself personally with Semyazi since the time you've been in Switzerland?
No, I haven't. My wife and I, we have seen light shows there late at night.
Uh-huh.
We have witnessed phenomena, which was unexplainable, but I've never seen, to the best of my knowledge, I've never seen a Pleiadian cosmonaut, nor have I seen a Pleiadian ship.
I understand. Willie, thank you very much for taking the time to answer my questions.
Maureen, thank you for your interest.
Thank you.
You know, this this case was the very first open mind show we ever did, was on Billy Meyer with
how
Wendell.
Exciting.
And it's odd that my introduction to Billy Meyer came about a year before when I was approached to do that screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't believe in flying saucers. When I saw the material, I was more than happy to do the screenplay, but then it never did materialize.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you both very much.
Okay, Marie.
Bye-bye.
And, Bruce.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yes, I was calling because I have a second book by Colonel Stevens. And I wondered if it was possible to write to the original addresses on the books to obtain more books, or due to his situation, is it impossible to get...
Think the best thing to do is to write to those addresses. His daughter would be glad, I'm sure, to answer your letter and advise you as to what's available.
Okay. And I had one other question, and that was that in reading these books, and I wasn't sure if I quite followed your answer to the other girl, but there seems to be a lot of information that wants to be, that the Pleiadians want to... a lot of things they want to say, and I wondered if those things will be coming out in time.
Well, we hope so. As I mentioned earlier, we've had our priorities, and there's just, you know, there's only so much you can do in a 24-hour period. And obviously, it's very expensive to continue an investigation like this. In fact, we more or less terminated this case as far as investigation in 1982. At the beginning. But we hope that eventually in the next 3 years there'll be a lot more information appearing on this case. One, and hopefully, will be the contact notes. Another will be this mainstream book, which will cover the, more or less the inside story. It's being done by a very qualified and very talented investigative reporter. And it should be a very, very, very interesting reading.
I think one of the things to bring up is that your involvement and Wendell's involvement was primarily in the into the investigation of the case, the validity of it, and that took precedence in your mind.
Totally.
And then the wealth of material that is coming out from this, from Billy Meyer, presents a problem for us over here in that it's in German, and it is costly to translate that into American. I know that when Edmund Slade was over there that... this is one of the things that they want to get done the most, is to have those contact notes translated into English so that we can have those over here, because there are some very powerful things that are said in them.
Yes, and if I might add, once you read Wendell's report and the documentation and his approach to it and the tests that were done, the entire book is stating a case, but now that the case is stated, I'd like to see what it's being stated about.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I do very much appreciate you know, all that you're doing, and the other thing that I wanted to touch on, but apparently Lee doesn't want to go into it, was what Colonel Stevens is doing now, or you know, what he'll be doing in the future.
Well, he's writing out his current problem, and he has a lot of plans for the future.
And he's in very good health. He's in very good spirits. And
riding like a banshee.
And we haven't heard the last of Wendell. Okay?
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Speaked in the first caller when he said he was wondering about what the message the Pleiadians had for us and what he was giving to Billy. Well, I have been corresponding with Billy Myers. And I have something in a letter. I will just read a portion of it to you, which I think might be very helpful. This was December 28, 1983. I asked in my letter what I could do to be helpful to help this world out of its mess.
And he says, you ask what you can do, and the answer is very simple. All the protests and demonstrations will come to naught, because humanity cannot be changed as a mass. But the change for the better must start with each individual. And if you can change yourself away from a materialistic way of thinking toward a more spiritual way of life and affect the persons around you, then you will have done as much as can be expected of you, of anyone else. All the best wishes for the future. Sincerely. I thought that would shed some light on what is expected of us.
Right on target, too, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly is.
I mentioned earlier, I don't know if you heard this, Eleanor, but I in Beamship, the movie footage, Billy talks about balancing.
Yes.
The material with spiritual.
Yes.
And that sort of sums it up, too.
It certainly does. Well, it's been a great privilege to talk with you again. And when you see Wendell, give him our very best from David and Eleanor.
I certainly will.
And much to both of you.
Thank you very much, Eleanor.
You're so welcome. Bye-bye.
And for sharing that with us. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me is Lee Elders, from promising them that we would play a little bit more of the audio tape that we played a little bit earlier. And I want you to hear the sounds of the Pleiadian spacecraft. Now, the sounds seem to be real, and what we are going to hear is in the control room of one of the sound laboratories here in town. Which one was it, Lee?
It was the Excalibur Studios.
Excalibur
North
Studios.
North Hollywood, I believe.
So you'll hear the sounds, and you'll hear the comments of the sound engineers, who are fellows who know exactly what they're doing and what they're hearing, and also what they're seeing on their scopes, as this sound that was recorded by Billy Meyer on a Philips tape recorder, as I recall, on an occasion, and their excitement and a bit of perplexity about what they are hearing and seeing is quite evident. So let's listen to that for a moment.
We're talking about radical changes that we've got on the spectrum analyzer. What is it telling you?
Okay, let's pick a point here on the screen. Let's pick that point there. You see how the level of that point is changing, it's going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
One point on the one line on the screen here is one frequency, and the whole screen is, you might say, a composite of a whole range of frequencies, all the way from very low up to the top of the audio range.
Mm-hmm.
And a pure tone would simply show a peak, you know, one, you know, the line would be down the bottom, and then it would be straight peak up like that,
mm-hmm.
because it was just one pure tone. But since there are many tones here, we get this pattern like this. And as you can see, it's not steady. It's changing.
It's changing, yeah.
Which means the content keeps changing also in our tape or the signal.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that seems to be any consistency, of having consistency, is the amplitude modulation.
Yeah. If we look at an expanded view of the signal here,
mm-hmm.
see that variation? So like that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That goes on the signal all the way through.
It does?
Yeah. That's the only stable pattern, as far as I can tell.
Can you show the frequency of modulation, of amplitude modulation, by speeding up the sweep on this?
No, what we got? When they get all, we'll have a whole bunch on there at the same time. What does that mean?
That means you have several, or quite a few, different times.
Quite a number of them.
Yeah, you can see the little peaks here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, compare this now to what we looked at before, within one peak. And you can see how many tones there are there. It's quite a few.
This is probably one of the most interesting things about the tape, is that there are...
What's this right now?
Very, very many tones.
Yeah.
And they're all changing very fast.
For a moment there, we were looking in and we had three evenly spaced frequencies. See it there again?
I got them again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you aware of anything that has this many tones and frequencies in it?
Well, there certainly aren't any synthesizers that have oscillators that are that many and that random, tuned to that many random things all changing simultaneously. That's, you know, that's not something inherent in any of the synthesizers that are used for, you know, recording or creating sound. This is something that has... a tremendous amount of oscillation at different frequencies.
Yeah. So you're saying it would be very difficult to produce this electronically?
Yes.
Would it be possible, though?
It is possible, but...
In this variety?
You have to consider your source. To create this on a Philips
tape deck...
If the Philips cassette came from...
The source that
it supposedly came from, it's... I don't see how the man could do it.
Okay, now you're running a comparison here of the sounds we're listening to, and there's the white noise down at the bottom.
Right?
What's the similarities between the two, and what are the really defined differences?
Okay, well, white noise is electronic, unwanted signal in any electronic system, and you see that on the bottom here. Put power in, and you can...
Mirage fighter that came in. And of course you've seen the photo. All right, there we were. It's fascinating stuff, Lee.
You've heard the second part of that, the variation two sounds, where the dog is barking.
Yes.
And the mirage fighter.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So we get all of those other little sounds that the scope is telling everybody about. A mirage fighter comes over, the dogs bark, and the spaceship is there. I mean... Billy must have a secret studio somewhere that defies conventional wisdom and science in order to produce those sounds on his little Philips tape recorder. We will play a little bit later the sounds of his first recording. That was a Variation 2?
Yes,
That was a Variation 6 craft. The Pleiadians are always changing models on us, quite like they've got a connection with General Motors.
You know, one of the things that's fascinating, too, is we, by the time we got in, you know, one of the problems with this case that I will always regret is the fact that we came in 2 years, almost 3 years too late after it had started, and there were only four photographs left of the Variation 1 type craft, and we managed to salvage, I think we have the four, but we've never released them. One of these days we will.
Yeah,
and you'll have all six craft, and you'll see a remarkable difference.
Yeah, the latest craft is a weird-looking thing with great big balls all along the outside of it.
Right.
But its capabilities are evidently enormous in that it can travel the distance from here to Pleiades, which is, what, 500 light-years or thereabouts, in a matter of a few minutes.
I think it's 7 minutes, seven and a half minutes.
And it used to take them an awful long time to make the trip, 7.5 hours.
Right.
So there's obviously no CHP up there with a speed limit. I'm talking to Lee Elders. I'll be right back in Wilton 2, by the way, Lee, at Alexandria 2 Bookstore. She just called in. They have four, I believe it is, so you better hurry. And they also are renting the beam tape. Or the beam ship tape, the footage, the Japanese footage there for you, that you have an opportunity you can get yourself for your collection. And this is not one of those kind of tapes, I think, that, well, if you rent it once, that'll be great, because then you'll want to buy one and keep it in a very, very special place, or it may leave the door because it's quite unusual footage. All right, Milton.
Hi, Bill.
Hi,
Lee.
Hi.
And
I've been listening to the sound of the spacecraft on your tape, and I think I have an explanation for you on it.
We'd love to hear it.
About 4 months ago, I was at the Bodhi Tree bookstore, and I found a book called The Janos People, J-A-N-O-S.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book is all about an English family that was taken aboard a spacecraft. Well, fortunately, the husband of this family was an engineer. And the whole family was taken on a Cook's tour of the spacecraft. And especially the husband, John, was taken into the power section of the spacecraft. Now, this UFO was about 350 feet in diameter. And down in the power section, John, the husband, was shown what amounted to a gigantic, huge beam. This is a metal beam that rode on a great big huge bearing that was in the middle of the spacecraft.
A metal beam?
A metal beam, yes. They don't say in the book exactly what the metal was.
Oh, but, you know, when you say beam, you're talking about like a beam overhead, not a beam of light.
Yes,
right,
I'm talking about a metal beam.
Mm-hmm.
And this beam, according to the book, was over 350 feet in length. Well, about 350 feet in length. And they used the beam and made the beam spin with electric power. And when they wanted to raise the spacecraft off the ground, why, they would crank up the beam and away it would go. And, of course, the faster the beam turned, the greater the power was and the faster the spacecraft would go. And they say, and the Janos people told him that they used the beam and made it turn and spin only when they were here in the atmosphere of the Earth. When they were beyond it, they didn't need it and didn't use it. But when I can easily visualize this beam spinning at a relatively high speed, I've forgotten how fast it turned, how it would produce the wavering sound that we heard on the tape.
Very interesting. How old is this book? When was it published?
This book, let me look in the front of it. I have it here in front of me.
It's called The Janos People?
Janos, J-A-N-O-S. The Janos People by Frank Johnson.
Hmm.
And the copyright, it says first published in Great Britain in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, second printing is in 1981.
Uh-huh.
Well, a spinning beam always can evoke all kinds of things, like the breaking of magnetic fields and pulsing of magnetic fields, all of which can make noise.
Uh-huh. And I'm sure that that beam, when it was spinning, would make a... It was a straight beam. It wasn't a three-legged beam or anything
mm-hmm.
like that, a rotor. Actually, they did in one place in the book call it a rotor. But mm-hmm. it was a straight metal beam, 300 feet or so in length, that would spin, and that was what counteracted in some way, not explained, how they counteracted and the gravitational force of the Earth.
These ships are about, 21 to 33 feet across, as I recall, Lee, and they are saucer-shaped.
Right.
With some variation on the top part of it there, but basically they're saucer-shaped craft. I think it was Wendell who was telling us that analysis of these sound tapes we also had, part of that sound could be explained by two rotating, say, wheels that are 21 feet across, one rotating in one direction, one the other, counter-rotating planes.
This is about, but I can easily understand, as the beam would spin, why, because of its length, and of course because of because of its length, why, you would get different sounds
mm-hmm.
out of the various sections of it as it would spin.
Sure, that's That's rather perceptive, and I see exactly where you're coming from on that, Milton. That could be so.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So maybe this helps everybody to understand where that sound comes from. Now, I have no idea if the same principle is used in all of the various UFOs, but at least it was in this particular group, and it sounds like the one that you're talking about uses the same principle.
They could be. Even though they come from very scattered points in the universe, physics is still physics.
Yes. The basic principles apparently work no matter who uses them.
That's right. This may be one day we can.
Yeah. I'm hoping that somebody will latch on to this idea and find out and make some experiments with it and see what's going on, and maybe they can make one for us.
Yeah. I think at the present time, those folks out there are not too interested in us getting too far into space. We'd rather stay in our own backyard
exactly.
until we get our act cleaned up.
Yes, we've got enough trouble down here.
We don't need to be exporting that.
Oh, yeah. By the way, Bill, it's a couple of years ago. I am the one who had the 20-minute visit from Natalie Wood on the day of her funeral.
Oh, yes. I remember you telling me about that.
Yes, yes. I wrote you a letter about it.
Yes, you did.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well,
any further visits?
I didn't hear you.
Any further visits?
No more visits after that one.
Well, let's hope all things are well.
Yes. Well, you see, the last remark I made to her, she didn't like to hear that at all. And so I don't think she decided she didn't like me.
Oh.
So she left and didn't come back.
All right, Milton, thank you very, very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you much.
We're 19 minutes away from midnight. At midnight, there will be a break for news, of course, and then Tom Hall will jump into this seat and keep going, and he's going to have quite a character with him tonight, an old friend of mine and probably a friend of yours, too. Gary Franklin will be here. Gary Franklin of Channel 2 fame. He and I used to work together over at KFWB. Gary is really into the movies, and he has a way of calling the shots as he sees them. You may not agree with him, but he certainly says the way he sees them, and he is he's quite a fella. So join Gary Franklin along with Tom Hall right after Little McBoy.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Lee. Sorry I tuned in kind of late on this show tonight because it's really a good one.
So am I sorry that you
I'm a co-worker with Dave Froning, which I heard you mention a couple of times. He kind of got me interested in these things. And I've read the investigation report and volume 2, the picture book, and I'm still looking for volume 1, which seems to be impossible to find. But...
Well, if you find it, get ready to depart with some money.
Yeah, I saw it about 2 years ago, and I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. I'll come back and buy it. And never saw one since. But anyway, my question concerned pretty much the propulsion of these things. It seems that they're kind of reluctant to divulge any specific physics of how they work, except generalities of that they do go into higher dimension, which seems to be a timeless, like, void, and they can transverse, you know, kind of go around the back of space, so to say, and get here in very short time. And I wanted to ask Lee, if there's been, like, any documentation of what they see in that dimension, you know, they tend to be saying that there's spiritual beings and there's also flesh and blood beings, like we are. And I was wondering if, when they go into that dimension, if that is the realm of these supposedly spiritual beings. And do you have any comments on that?
Our information is very, very limited in that area. Extremely limited.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Lee?
Oh, sure. Our information in that area is extremely limited. Now, Meyer did ask questions, but he was told that, they couldn't answer certain questions. And in reviewing the contact notes, you see this all the way through. When it comes to propulsion, they give you a few hints, a few keys, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the manufacture of the metal, we do know that there's 7 processes that the metal goes through. Vogel came close, I think, when he was analyzing the 3 or 4 segments that he got into. But we really don't have all the answers. Now, I don't know if they're giving us subliminal clues It's up to us to figure out what it is.
They gave him enough clues about the propulsion system in a very general way, and he wrote about them, as I recall, one of Wendell's conversations here, that when physicists at NASA looked at some of those notes, said that this one-armed farmer who was in the sixth grade was talking about things that they see on the drawing board for 100 years from now.
Yeah.
The jump propulsion system and some of the others, which was simply a matter of breaking down the space-time continuum. We are now able to break down that space-time continuum, by the way.
Have they given any reason for the updating of the ships, like the designs? I was curious, you know, they're talking about going into a higher dimension to travel, and I didn't know if with the updating of the new ships, if they're even using maybe even higher dimensions, because you said they've cut down the time.
They hired some designers from General Motors.
Well, one of the problems, now this new ship surfaced for the first time in 1981, and Billy went out to a forest preserve named Dirt Stolen, and there he took like 27 photographs. We take, Billy, sometime we have a chance, Bill, I'd like to send you some of these transcripts or the tapes themselves. Britt spent a lot of time with Billy on this issue. And out of 27 photographs, that was it. And then they retired the ship. I'm talking about Variation 6 now. They claim that the pollutants in our environment, in our atmosphere, the metal started to break down, and they had to retire it. And they went back to the old standby, the DC-3, as you may, Variation 2. And we only got to see that ship for a very brief period of time.
Is that the one with all of the big balls around it?
Yes, the cylinders, yes.
So it's no longer in service.
Rob Shellman, when he was analyzing this, it was very interesting. We were up in Seattle. He was analyzing. He had never seen photographs of Variation 6. And he all of a sudden he started drawing these circles on this plain piece of white paper. And he drew about seven or eight of them. And he says, to me it sounds like they're generating a magnetic wave. And what he was doing was drawing the cylinders around the ship. And then when we showed him the photograph, that blew him away. And that happened in 1982.
Well, my friend John Bedini has looked at that carefully, and he thinks that those are generating an A-field, which generates a time wave, which is... don't ask me to explain that. I just repeat what they tell me.
Yes.
When you say that the travel time is 7 hours, now it's down like 7 minutes, is that the time of the occupants relative to them on the ship, or is it like an instantaneous happening to them?
As Billy explained it, it was this way. It takes them approximately 3.5 minutes to leave. I'm talking about the, I guess we would call the gravity pull of the Pleiades, and 3.5 minutes to enter into, through our gravity pull of our system. So in essence, it's instantaneous.
Mm-hmm. Most of the journey.
That's
for only Variation 6. The other ships cannot do that.
That fast. Yeah, they have to speed. They have to speed up to a null point, and then they have to slow down from it. But the actual job of getting from here to there, other than the speed up slow down time, is a total folding of space time.
Hmm.
And if you want to know what that's like, just get a piece of paper. And if you want to go from one corner of it to the opposite corner, well, if you traveled linearly, it would take you, say, 500 light years. But fold those two corners together, and you could see you could jump from corner to corner in a microsecond.
Yes.
Well, I would like you to ask your friend Dave about this. I mean, he could answer this question much better than I can.
Yeah, it's also speculative, you know, and
Oh, sure.
You kind of work under the covers at being a big engineering firm, because a lot of the people there kind of look at you, you start even mentioning it, and they go,
Well, I've talked to a lot of those aerospace engineers, and there's quite a legion of them that have a rough organization. And they're putting a lot of facts that have come into each one of those aerospace firms about UFOs together privately, and are really telling quite a story.
Yes. Well, there is quite a bit of research being done on it, contrary to what a lot of people think. Just in the circles that I'm in, I see a lot of it, and it's got to the point where it's more than just mind, you know, like think tank things.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very interesting. I'm very excited about getting any new information that comes out, so I'll be looking forward to.
Have you seen the footage?
No, I haven't. In fact, I got the thing in the flyer yesterday and Mill from Genesis 3 on it.
Wow, I think you'll really enjoy that. There's a lot of not only information in it, because we cover Billy for the first 17 minutes and how he takes his photographs, and we take you to Hassenbohl and show you the site where he took hundreds of photographs, and then we go into the movie footage. It's quite interesting, Kate.
Yes. Well, I'm from an area of the United States, Midwest, Indiana, where there's a lot of prevalent UFO sightings, and I've seen one or two myself. In fact, it's close to Muncie, where they filmed the beginning part of Close Encounters. And I thought that was very fitting, because there are a lot seen there, so they must have done the research a little bit when they made that movie. But, okay, General, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Good night.
What is that address again, in case someone missed it as we've given it here?
Yes. It's Craig.
Oh, Craig.
Right. Bill, we were in contact with you a couple years ago. My father is Leon. I don't know if you remember.
I believe...
We had some letters back and forth.
Yes.
And actually, I wanted to ask Lee, we had sent a tape in to Wendell a while back, made from a crystal that we had found here in Northridge.
Uh-huh.
Made from the crystal?
Well, a tape, right. We were recording. We had found the crystal, and we had started making a recording. I was recording just something in the house, and when we played back the recording, it had a bunch of frequencies and was making everything echo, and then we just recorded the crystal itself, and when someone would hold it, it would change pitch.
Crystals do
that. And Wendell, when he heard it, we played it for him over the phone, said that it matched the tape that he had heard from someone in Canada.
Yes,
so we had sent him a copy of the tape, and we sent him a bunch
of that tape, yes.
You have a copy of the Canadian tape or theirs?
I'm sorry, of the Canadian tape of the saucer.
Right.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear theirs?
No, did you ever receive our tape is what I want to
say. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't. You sent it to...
To Wendell.
To Wendell? Gosh, I don't know, but I'll certainly find out for you.
Okay, also, you know, I guess we should contact Wendell again. My father is a very good telepathic receiver and receives things all the time. And in fact, we, alongside, we're doing quite a bit of our own research into the ancient history aspect of the Pleiades.
Yes.
And I have quite a bit of information that I'm going to send you that's up to date on some of the
stuff
that
we're
doing.
Oh, we'd love to have it. We haven't even scratched the surface in that area. I was talking to, I think, a Marine earlier, young lady, and I told her about our priorities, and that's one of them that we're really lacking in, and I wish we had more information.
Right. Well, I've got tons of it. I've spent the past 6.5 years on my spare time doing research into the ancient history aspect of it.
Well, then you're very familiar with the synchronicity of seven.
Definitely. And, you know, there's no culture or race or civilization throughout ancient history in any part of the world that doesn't have some sort of connection in its mythology or legends that's dealing with the Pleiades.
Well, that's one of the things that really got our attention, because, first of all, how could this little, like Bill calls him, this little guy over there, hoax this entire thing? But also, how would he know about the connection there with all the civilizations
right
with this star group? And, you know, normally where there's smoke, there's fire.
Right. You know, one of the amazing things is that both the Egyptian and the Mayan hieroglyphic for Pleiades are identical. And you're talking two civilizations that were not only thousands of miles apart, but thousands of years apart.
Well, the Great Pyramid is a standing tribute to Pleiades.
Right, and some of the Mayan ones are as well, and then there's a definite connection there.
And you've seen Volume 2, I would guess, on the Native American connection to the
right.
Pleiades.
Right,
that we just found recently, and that literally was mind-boggling to us.
Oh, yes. I have some stuff I'll be sending you, or I'd like to send.
Please do. We'd love to have, especially in that area, because, as I say, we've been very lax in researching that area because we've had other things to do.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, Craig?
Okay, terrific. And I guess I'll just call Wendell then and get in touch with you that way.
All right.
Okay, right. Thanks a lot, though.
Very good. And Florence, you're up.
Hello, Bill.
Hi.
Is Wendell Stevens going to be back on? I heard him a few weeks ago.
You heard him a few weeks ago?
Yeah, wasn't he on your show? Or do I have him confused with someone else?
I had Edwin Slade on about 6 weeks ago. I haven't had Wendell on in a couple of years.
Okay, is Edwin Slade the man from Las Vegas?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just had the names mixed up.
Yeah.
Well, talking about the size of the ships a little while ago, this man called in about a metal beam 350 feet long. Aren't some of the
motherships that stay in the upper atmosphere much larger than the ships that come down.
They defy imagination in size.
Yeah, like a football field.
Oh, no, much, much larger than that.
If I can quote Billy here now, if I can jump right in on this, you might find it interesting, both of you. The next tape we're doing, which will probably be April and May of next year, is called The Meyer Chronicles. It'll be 2 hours. But there's an interesting segment there where Yowie Junichi asked Billy what it's like on board the ship. And they're walking out to a site, and Billy says it's like a watching central. Now, this is one of the major problems we had with Meyer for about a year and a half, and that was breaking down his code. And there was a code there.